evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, December the 9th, 2014. The UN mission in South Sudan destroys stockpile of weapons belonging to the internally displaced persons.
Over the past 12 months, UNMISS has recovered firearms and other weapons along with ammunition at its protection of civilian site. In most instances, these weapons have been surrendered by civilians and ex-combatants seeking shelter at the site.
And an international aid agency says South Sudanese children affected by the conflict have been ignored.
Children are suffering as this crisis in South Sudan continues. Children are afraid, both of the violence that they've experienced, but also the violence that's still occurring all around them. Rather than attending school, children are being put to work in the protection of civilian sites.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
Today in Juba, the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, began destroying weapons collected from internally displaced persons, or IDPs, who have sought refuge in protection of civilian sites since fighting began last December. The UN hopes by destroying the weapons, it will send a strong message that it wants peace to be restored in South Sudan. Philip Thornaleu attended the event and filed this report for VOA.
That is the sound of a UN mine action machine cutting an AK for the same rifle into three pieces. The aim of the exercise at the UN's Tongping base near Juba Airport is to ensure that this weapon is completely unusable. 15 other AK-47s and 10 pistols were also crushed this morning, along with machetes, knives, even sticks that were seized from civilians as they entered UN protection of civilian sites when fighting broke out nearly a year ago. UNMISS head Helen Magrese Loy says cutting the weapon into pieces and making them unusable is meant to send a message that United Nations is committed to peace and nonviolence.
Over the past 12 months, UNMISS has recovered firearms and other weapons along with ammunition at its protection of civilian site. In most instances, these weapons have been surrendered by civilians and ex-combatants seeking shelter at the sites. In other cases, they have been confiscated during operations that UNMISS periodically conduct inside the protection sites in search of weapons, alcohol, drugs, and other smuggled items.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians have taken refuge at UNMISS bases around South Sudan since fighting started last December. Loy says weapons confiscated from civilians and air combatants in the capitals of Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile states, where the fighting has been the most intense, will also be destroyed. And she says UNMISS officials have been vigilant about tracking the weapons.
Throughout the crisis, UNMISS has kept a careful inventory of the arms and ammunition it has seized. And there's no truth whatsoever to the baseless rumors that internally displaced persons have broken into containers housing these items and stolen their contents.
Loy says the destruction of weapons will send a clear message to South Sudanese politicians that they must stop all forms of violence, including human rights abuses.
I call upon the warring parties to refrain from further acts of violence and fully abide by the secession of hostilities agreement they signed on 23rd January of this year. I also urge the political leaders of South Sudan to expedite negotiations on the conclusion of a sustainable and comprehensive peace agreement and the formation of a transitional government of national unity so that all South Sudanese can return home and pursue their daily life in peace.
No government representatives witnessed today's weapon destruction exercise. But Joe Contreras, the spokesman for UNMISS, says the government was fully aware of today's event and the others that are being planned.
I can assure you that this event and the series of events that will follow involving the destruction of weapons and ammunition recovered from internally displaced persons is being done with the complete support of the Ministry of Defense and the rest of the South Sudanese government. There was an agreement reached with them. We would not be unilaterally going forward with the destruction of these weapons without their concurrence.
President Salva Kiir has in the past requested that weapons seized from people seeking protections from enemies be returned to the government. The year-old conflict pins forces loyal to President Kiir against those who back his former deputy, Riek Machar. At least 10,000 people have been killed and nearly 2 million have been forced to flee their homes. Peace talks between government and opposition have been suspended by mediators from regional bloc IGAD to give both sides time to consult their constituencies about key issues, including the makeup of a transitional government. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
Humanitarian aid organization World Vision says in a new report that children have hit hard by the violence in South Sudan. World Vision interviewed 160 children in the three locations in South Sudan to find out how they have been affected by the ongoing conflict and how they want their lives to change. Wake Simon Wudu attended the launch of the report in Juba.
Upper Nile is one of the states that have been hardest hit by a year of fighting in South Sudan. And yet children in Upper Nile, like these whose voices bring a little joy to Kodok village, still play amidst the violence around them. World Vision researchers say in the report released yesterday in Juba that thousands of South Sudanese children are believed to have been neglected by both government and aid organizations that are trying to address humanitarian problems resulting from the conflict. Perry Mansfield is the national country director of World Vision in South Sudan. Mansfield says emergency programs have received almost three-quarters of the funding they need from international donors to address urgent needs such as shelter, medical care, and education. But he says programs that ensure the protection and well-being of people, particularly children, are nowhere near being fully funded.
As South Sudan is threatened by being torn apart, the voices of the children are unheard.
Research was conducted in October for the World Vision report entitled Fear and Want: Children Living in Crisis in South Sudan. Interviewers met with 160 children aged 5 to 18 in Protection of Civilians or POC sites that are a year into the crisis still house tens of thousands of internally displaced persons. The interviews were conducted in three locations in central Equatoria and Upper Nile states. The report estimates that 750,000 children have been displaced by the conflict and that 400,000 others have had to drop out of school.
Children are suffering as this crisis in South Sudan continues. Children are afraid, both of the violence that they've experienced, but also the violence that's still occurring all around them. Rather than attending school, children are being put to work in the protection of civilian sites.
The report says more than 1,100 schools in the three states mostly affected by the violence, Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity, have been closed since the conflict broke out last December. Another 124 schools are reportedly occupied by forces from either side in the conflict and being used for military purposes, the report says. The report goes on to tell of some of the harrowing experiences children in South Sudan are enduring. Children have watched as army tanks mangle bodies. They have fled violence with their families. They have been separated from their parents or been orphaned, and many been recruited to fight in the conflict. To Mansfield, the children of South Sudan are calling out for help.
We in the international community can humble ourselves and put the needs of the most vulnerable, the children, before our own. In unison with the children of South Sudan, we call for an end to the violence. We call for children to be reunited with their families, with their homes, and their communities. and for children to be protected from violence at all times, for children to be given the opportunity to learn.
Fatuma Ibrahim is the UNICEF Chief Child Protection Officer in South Sudan. She says public officials and civil society need to act now to prevent irreparable harm being done to South Sudan's children.
It means we need to look at what is happening to the children now. Because if we don't do things now to help them have a better well-being, then we will not have a future. And for South Sudan, children, I think, are the most important resource. Let's forget about the oil. Let's forget about everything else. And for me, what I would like to see in a year's time, not fear and want, but hope and opportunities for children.
According to World Vision, about half of South Sudan's population is aged 18 and under. But although they may be classified as children in terms of age, the words of one girl interviewed by World Vision suggest that children affected by South Sudan's conflict will never again experience anything close to childlike innocence. 12-year-old Mariam said, "I am afraid that if war comes again to Juba, the tanks will come to the protection of civilian site and crush us." For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
We now move to Kenya. Kenya has seen a spate of cross-border attacks by Somali militants who are apparently seeking revenge for Kenyan military involvement in Somalia. But neighboring Ethiopia, which also shares a long border with Somalia and has troops in the country, has avoided the same fate. This report by Gabe Joslo in Nairobi looks into why this might be the case and what lessons Kenya can learn from Ethiopia to better protect its borders.
Kenya has a security problem. Fighters from the militant group Al-Shabaab, driven from their strongholds across Somalia, have claimed responsibility for gruesome attacks targeting non-Muslims in northeastern Kenya, hijacking a bus full of passengers in one recent incident and attacking quarry workers as they slept in their tents in another. Bill Okero is a senator from Mandera County in Kenya on the border with Somalia, the county where both attacks took place.
And so we have a situation where most of the Al-Shabaab forces seem to be largely in control of the area bordering Mandera. This is a ghetto region. So we have a situation where we have the large numbers of these people there, and we don't have a border really that is properly secured.
Caro has noticed that Kenya's neighbor to the north, Ethiopia, has had much more success preventing terrorism on its own soil, despite having a much longer border with Somalia and a longer history of military involvement in the country. And he thinks Kenya should look to Ethiopia as a model.
What I know is on most of its border, they have created a buffer, almost 50 to 100 kilometers, and any activity by these groups on those in that region will be met by an incursion directly that will immediately eliminate the threat.
There have been some terrorist incidents in Ethiopia, but not nearly on the same scale as Kenya. In 2013, a bomb exploded in the capital, Addis Ababa, allegedly killing two militant operatives. The U.S. Embassy warned in October this year of another Al-Shabaab threat in the Ethiopian capital, though nothing apparently came of it. Kedrick Barnes, Horn of Africa project director at the International Crisis Group, attributes much of Ethiopia's anti-terror success to its work developing a police force from local communities in the ethnically Somali East.
Over the last few years, you've seen Ethiopia devolve a lot of security to a locally recruited police force called the Leo Police, who are basically local Somalis that are trained in, they're police, but there's also counterinsurgency.
But Barnes notes that Ethiopia's system is not necessarily translatable to Kenya. For one thing, Ethiopia has been security-minded for years, he says, and has radically devolved power to local authorities, a process Kenya is just beginning to implement. Barnes says imposing an Ethiopian-style security mechanism in Kenya could mean rolling back some of the political liberalization that has taken place, particularly in the Somali-dominated northeast.
There are so many gains that have been made. It would be a real pity to reverse some of those in the interests of a security threat, which could be dealt with fairly easily by better intelligence, a more devolved police force especially.
There are also serious rights concerns. Ethiopian security forces often round up Al-Shabaab suspects under a controversial 2009 anti-terrorism law that has also been used to prosecute journalists and political opponents. Leslie Lefko, Deputy Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, says such strong-arm security tactics come at a cost.
there is absolutely no space in Ethiopia today for citizens to express themselves peacefully, whether in print or in protests. And I think one of the concerns that we have is that this kind of iron grip is not a recipe for long-term stability.
The Ethiopian government has repeatedly denied using anti-terror laws for anything other than security of the country. Kenya, too, is considering revamping its laws to give police more power to detain terror suspects, which, like Ethiopia's law, is likely to raise questions about whether the country is trading rights for security. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello, I'm Jimmy Carter. I would like to talk with you about the heroes all around you. Some of these heroes are people who had Ebola, went to a treatment center, and got better. These people can no longer spread Ebola, and their families and communities can safely welcome them back home. Just as deserving of our respect are the heroes, many of them your neighbors, who fight Ebola every day as nurses, hospital cleaners, burial teams, ambulance drivers, and community health workers. Help and respect these brave people as they do their jobs. Working together, we can stop Ebola.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we'll take a look at the problems facing journalists in South Sudan after this break.
South Sudan in Focus listeners can find us on the following shortwave frequencies: 11900, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite meal to cook?
My favorite is nsima with chambo, because I walk a lot. I do things on foot or walking, so I like things that can give me energy.
The favorite food that I like to cook is rice and eggs. I love eggs because they are nutritious, they give proteins to my body, so yeah, I love them.
My favorite meals to cook is chips, rice, vegetables.
Mm-hmm. My favorite meal to cook is beans, and the reason being that it's my staple food.
One food is South Sudanese food called kop. I love that food. Second food is an Ethiopian food called anjer. These are the two food I love so much.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Welcome to our weekly health segment. Today we are looking at malaria. The World Health Organization reports say that there has been a dramatic fall in the number of malaria deaths since 2000, and the number of cases is also slowly going down. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Sub-Saharan Africa bears the brunt of malaria, with 90% of global deaths occurring there. But this year's World Malaria Report says Africa's population has grown by 43% since 2000, with fewer people getting infected. WHO Global Malaria Program Director Pedro Alonso says the number of people infected fell from 173 million in 2000 to 128 million in 2013. He says that is particularly good news for children, who are the biggest victims of this fatal but preventable disease.
Mortality in children under five, the age group which concentrates the biggest malaria problem in terms of severe disease and death, has reduced by a staggering 58%. And if we try to quantify the number of lives saved since 2000 up to 2014, We estimate that over 4 million deaths have been averted.
The World Health Organization says the results are due to greater access to malaria control interventions. It notes in 2013, almost half the people at risk of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa had access to an insecticide-treated mosquito net. It says a record 214 million bed nets will be delivered to endemic countries in Africa by the end of the year. Dr. Alonso says greater access to rapid diagnostic tests and effective treatment also has significantly improved. He says these are not complex, expensive interventions, and health systems can build on these measures.
We also need to sustain a strong pipeline of research and development and innovation to develop new tools. We face significant challenges with the emergence and spread of artemisinin resistance, particularly in Southeast Asia. We need to tackle that problem, and we can tackle it in both ways, by developing new drugs that could potentially take over from ACTs if and when they fail and that resistance spreads.
Another sign of progress is the increasing number of countries moving toward malaria elimination. In 2013, WHO says two countries, Azerbaijan and Sri Lanka, reported no cases of malaria, joining 11 countries, including Argentina, Egypt, Iraq, Oman, and Turkmenistan, that succeeded in maintaining zero cases. But the report says indoor residual spraying has decreased in recent years, and insecticide resistance has been reported in 49 countries. The WHO also says only about one half the $5.1 billion needed to prevent and control malaria has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It has been nearly a year since South Sudan plunged into conflict, and in the run-up to the one-year anniversary of the start of the fighting, South Sudan in Focus is airing a series of stories on how the unrest has affected almost every aspect of people's lives. Today, we bring you a report on the impact of violence on journalists and their constitutional right to freely express themselves. Foreign Minister Barnaba Marial told South Sudan in Focus last week that the recently passed media laws provide journalists with all the protection they need. He said if any journalist is harassed, they simply have to take their case to the courts.
In October, Daniel Majakwak, a reporter with the National Mirror newspaper in Juba, was getting ready to go out on assignment. Majakwak was working on a story about the demolition of makeshift structures in Juba town. His first step was to interview some officials in the capital. Next, he was going to interview some people who were affected by the demolition. But before Majakwak could complete his work, he was arrested. The police confiscated his equipment and questioned him for 3 hours.
Why did you go and interview the victim, the women which were actually the victim of the demolition? And that was very intentional. It was very important for the conception of the readership. How does this demolition affect them? Because they have been making their livelihood. That's what the authorities was not going well with them. Honestly, they prevented me not to do balance the story.
Majakwak says the authorities do not want journalists to cover some stories, including those that touch on accountability and human rights. Ilamu Dennis Ijuru, who works for the corporate newspaper in Juba, agrees. He says despite the media laws that were passed this year, journalists are censoring their own work, including when it involves critical issues.
We don't feel still free as journalists because we feel the state is everywhere and we cannot express ourselves so freely. That's the issue. Issues like to do with maybe issues on corruption, issues on ethnicity. They are taken as, you know, inciting, you know, tribes against other tribes.
Majakwak says the authorities need to stop looking at journalists as their rivals or even their enemies. They need to understand that journalists can play a role in building the nation.
I think it is out of the ignorant and a wrong perception that the media are gossipers and are for the sake of spoiling the image of an institution. it is only for the wrong perception. Disseminating the information in a well-contended manner, when I have a very balanced and fair story, I have to educate my people, I have to create awareness.
Rachel Achol, a reporter with the Citizen newspaper, says there were some limits on free speech in South Sudan even before the conflict. The crisis has made the situation worse, she says.
They don't want to talk because they fear that if he or she is identified, he or she might be in the problem.
The Citizen newspaper has had several of its print runs confiscated since the fighting began. The same has happened to other newspapers around the country. Kaunde David James, a news programmer at City FM, says his radio station was forced to stop broadcasting news programs when the conflict began. The news shows are still off the air.
We were working with text messages and they have to be filtered before you speak them on air. But somehow the situation was okay, and later on there was the issue of not reporting on the rebel side, and the shutdown of Bakita Radio.
Charge-run Bakita Radio was closed for about a month in August after airing a report that the government said misinformed the public. Bakita is said to have quoted a rebel voice that blamed the government for starting fighting in Unity State. South Sudanese Information Minister Michael Makwey has threatened to prosecute journalists who report the views of rebels. He called journalists who do so, quote, rebels and agitators. James says the media law that was signed by President Kiir in October is supposed to provide journalists with protection and allow them to do their jobs. James says he thinks the law should be followed to the letter. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
That report was written and prepared by Mugume David Zwakarin in Juba. And with that story, we bring you to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with a song, Stand Alone by K Deng. You may make myself out of my youth. As if I'm injured, oh, illness, but not. As if I'm weak and low, silent, but not. You made me unable to operate normally, temporarily, unable to move and think fairly. You made me very emotional ill. I saw you need me to be unsuccessful in life. That's why I'm unaccessible. You made me fail to think of any practical solution. Soon owned a surprise of revolution. Yeah, I'm standing here. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, standing there. I have to stand alone for a reason why. You made me blind not to see anything. You made me deaf not to hear anything. You lock my nose not to breathe anymore. You control my tongue not to stay in itself. You paralyze my arms not to stretch itself. You paralyze my leg not to move anymore. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I got access to the process. I'm owning access to the success. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Solution in my society. Need to not do things that people expect me to do. Look, I'm not a chip satisfactory upstandard. You made me fail a safety test. Right now, I'm ready to protest. Standing on my own, living nose in nose, showing you strongly I disagree to do. Stay with you and I agree. We must lead fathers away from center of love. A mistake may come and bind us back in buff. I suggest it must be no. Eyes on me from my top to my broom. Young is me, fresh man seeking for room. Now I'm back, you receive me with joy. Together with music and dance, we must enjoy. So glad happiness, cause my song gave them hop. Hip hop revolution. We've been listening to K Deng with the song Stand Alone. I'm Michael Atit in Washington.
And I'm John Tanza, also in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.